Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting live from Jerusalem now, not Brooklyn, from Jerusalem to the world. You're part of it wherever you are. Shalom and welcome. We're in the meditation room of the Pardes Yeshiva. That's because every room is busy today, so we're in a funny little room today, and I'm here with Rabbi Mike Foyer. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
Hi, Yishai. I'm feeling very mellow.
No, you're not. You're all stressed because you got a million things going on right now.
Yeah, but we're in the meditation room.
That's right. That's right. You do have a lot of stuff going on right now. You got
Don't we all?
You got a lot of classes you're teaching, and you also have your father's Yahrzeit coming up.
B'zat Hashem, Thursday night.
My father's Yahrzeit was yesterday.
Wow.
Yes, it was yesterday, and we wanted to go to the tomb. We couldn't do it. Hopefully this Friday we'll go. And I just came back from America. I was in San Francisco and New York, and I'm leaving on Sunday for Limud for a conference in Birmingham, England.
You've joined the jet set.
I'm in the jet set. Sometimes it's fun. You meet good people along the way. You meet a lot of good people, and I got to see a lot of my good friends over this last trip, including my good friend Andy Wells and my good friends in Brooklyn. My friend Jack and Sarah and Lillian and Moshe. It was just so fun to see everybody and reconnect with everybody. And also the Chevron Fund, which is the American wing of the Jewish community of Chevron, or the Friends of, is having right now, I think by the time people are listening to this, it'll be over, but we're having a charity matching campaign. And a lot of these people that I mentioned, and my friend Jeff in Australia and other people, my family, everybody donated, and I really want to thank everybody so much. And I want to thank everybody for giving, but I also I'm like, how lucky am I that I've helped I myself and I've helped my friends come to a consciousness of helping the Jewish community of Hebron, but a Jewish community in the land of Israel grow and thrive. Like, I feel like I want to thank my friends who donated, but I also want to say to them, you're welcome. You know? Like, wow, like connecting people to helping build Israel. What a schut. What a schut. What an incredible thing. We have a great Torah portion coming up right now, which is Vayeshev. It's got one of my favorite pieces in it, favorite Torah. Maybe if you ask me what my number one favorite Torah piece is, it's in this week's Torah portion. So there's definitely what to talk about. At the same time, we're talking about a really not easy swing. It's like moving into that famously hard, emotionally hard thing to deal with, which is the sale of Joseph. And we're basically, Joseph is going to come on the scene, and we're going to deal with the fact that his own brother is going to become very jealous of him, and they're going to sell him down the river. It's going to be like some kind of like black hymn from American before the Civil Revolution.
Well, that's because the slave community had a deep identification with Joseph for that very reason. Right. This story is not only painful in its immediacy, but it has consequences for, really in a certain sense, the rest of Jewish history. Mm-hmm. Because the question of who holds the true line from Jacob, right, whose vision is real, and then how the rest of the children of Israel respond to them. Do they see him as a leader? Do they see them as a threat? Do they see them as a sort of unrealistic dreamer? Right. This is something which plays itself out to our very day.
Well, more than he's an unrealistic dreamer, and yet he's one of the most realistic of them all. This guy knows how to manage, handle the situation.
He comes into that. Yes, he comes into that. But in the beginning, you get this image of someone who actually can't handle it.
Well, let's go through it a little
bit.
Let's
start. Start at the beginning.
The first thing is Joseph is born, and he's going to become, be 17 years old, and he's going to be a shepherd. But somehow he speaks bad of his brothers. The Torah seems to give him a little like wagging of the finger, like you're not doing right by speaking bad about your own brothers. And right there, you already start seeing that there's going to be a split with his own brothers. And then that's exacerbated by the fact that Jacob is going to favor him. And interestingly enough, the Torah is going to use the term Israel in terms. And you would have thought that maybe it would be a more Jacobian a type of character trait, but it says that Israel loved Joseph from more than all of his brothers. And we've seen before that Jacob has got this, sometimes this favoritism. He plays favoritism with wives. There's a connection here between his love of Rachel and the love of Joseph, this son who's born to him in his old age.
I mean, absolutely. Absolutely a connection to Rachel. And a deep question. I mean, as a parent, every parent wants to say that they love all their children equally. And I think it's generally a falsehood. I think that an honest parent and an emotionally healthy parent loves all their children as they need. But I don't think it's true, and I don't think we need to slide into discussion of what love is, but I don't think it's true that you love everyone equally. In fact, you know, there's a deep lesson in this for the idea of God's love for Israel. You know, one of these challenging notions, the chosen people, Am Segula, this treasured nation that God says, you know, I love you. What am I supposed to do? Right? And a lot of people are uncomfortable with that notion. Well, shouldn't God love everyone? Shouldn't Jacob love all his sons the same? And yet the reality is love is never the same for everyone. Right? That's an impartial judge. If God's a judge, if Jacob acts as a judge to his children, so then everyone gets exactly what they need, the exact same thing. It's always going to be fair. You know. But if he's a father, then there's an intimacy in that relationship which is going to evoke real love. And the power of the positive side of this sort of partiality, as you called it, is the fact that you know that he could passionately love Yosef, and therefore he could passionately love anyone.
Okay. I definitely hear that, but there is also something, I think the Torah is trying to signal that there's something a little bit wrong in this favoritism. I mean, that's the way I understood it.
I think what was wrong with it is the fact the way he showed it. Because if you look, what's the the classic image that represents Jacob's love for Joseph?
I was going to get to that exactly. The famous Ketonet Pasim, the
many-colored
coats, or the Technicolor dream coat.
Right, exactly, which is exactly what his brothers identify when they see him coming, which is exactly what they strip off him, dip in the blood, and show back to right. Yaakov when they want to demonstrate to him that.
But just for a second, let's tighten that. Jacob gives him this famous cloak of many colors, a robe of sorts, a kind of. And if you think about a robe or like a vest, sometimes those things are exactly what you put on over your clothes to show that, like, okay, I'm a regular guy, but there's one more level, or wearing a jacket.
It's a day for the vest. It's a special occasion, right? It shows the specialness.
Right, and he's wearing this around, and then the next stage is going to come. So basically, one, we heard that he speaks badly about his brother sometimes. Second thing is he gets this special, very colorful vest, ostensibly. And third is he's going to get these dreams. Now here, I wanted to ask you about this. By the way, if I didn't say Rabbi Mike Foyer, educational director, Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, and teacher here at Pardes, and we are on the Land of Israel Network, landofisrael.com, many other great shows, including your show called The Jewish Story, and many other great programs. So thank you so much for being with us. My email is yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Now, we're talking about dreams. This is what I wanted to ask you about. That here God, in last week's Torah portion in Vayishlach, God, G-D, was talking directly to Jacob, and your name shall be Israel, and I promise to give your children this land. Very classic I-thou relationship. God is talking, and he's telling you things. Here, there's a shift, okay? We know that Jacob is the last of the three forefathers. Joseph is already a different generational thing, and certainly you, Rabbi Mike, who talks a lot about Jewish history, deals with these different periods, different, there's different
phases,
the Mishnah, the Talmud, different people in that. So now there's a different phase, and now God is going to be talking to Joseph in these dreams, these crazy dreams, right, where basically the dream is about the supremacy of Joseph over the other brothers. The two famous dreams, you know, one is that there's these bundles, these
sheaves of wheat.
Sheaves of wheat, and they all kind of. If by the way, they did a great job in that movie, Joseph. What is it? It's the same line of as the.
It's Prince of Egypt.
Prince of Egypt.
I didn't know they made a Joseph movie.
Yes, and it's good.
Oh yeah,
it's good. Okay. It's quite good. I like those movies. Some people hate. They think it's wrong to draw out movies of the Bible. I like it. I say good. Give people a sense. That's what I think. But anyway. They did a great job. Something Prince of Dreams or whatever it is. It's a very good movie. And anyway, so you see it very beautifully that these sheaves kind of circle around his sheath?
Sheaf.
With a what?
An F.
With an F. Sheaf. Anyway, bundle. And these 11 bundles bow down to his bundle, right? That's one dream. And then the other dream, which is even more quote-unquote egregious, is that there's going to be 11 stars and the sun and the moon are going to bow down to him. And it's like 11 stars, that's the brothers, the sun and the moon, that's the mother, and that's Yaakov, and then there's a famous mystery, who is the moon itself? Is it his own mother? who's going to be dead, or is it Leia, the mother of his brothers? Probably that. In any case, he tells them these dreams, and he's agitating them to no end, to the point that they're like they can't look at him in the face anymore. They can't speak with him calmly. He's going to alienate himself.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to alienate himself, and then finally, what's going to happen is that. Is that when Jacob sends him to search for his brothers, he's going to come to Shechem. And there in Shechem, he's connected to Shechem somehow. He's going to bump into a person. Who is this dude? Who is it? Well, we're told that it's the angel Gabriel. That's not what the Bible says. It just says a person, but that's what our tradition teaches us. And he's going to say they went to Dotan. They went to this other place. And by the time that they see him coming to him, he's looking for his brothers. He wants his brothers' love. That's what the Torah tells us, I'm searching for my brothers. By the time they see him, they remember all of these things. He's spoken bad about them. His father favors him. And he gave him this technical dream code and these dreams. He thinks he's so much better than us. We're going to do something to him.
So, I mean, you didn't pose the question, but I think it was implicit in what you said, which is, why is it that Yaakov merits to God's direct voice, whereas Yosef's experience is these sort of abstract, imagetic dreams?
Right, these dreams. What, that was the question, right. Thank you. I lost my track for a second.
No, you gave a good rundown. And I think that a lot of it has to do with two things. The one you put your finger on is that we're in a time of transition here, that Yosef actually is the bridge between a world of spiritual archetypes, of individuals whose personal path of divine service will serve Am Yisrael for all time to come as modes of relationship to God. And so Yosef is carrying that on one hand and adding his own piece to it, which we're going to have to discuss what that is in the coming parshiot. I think the other one is simply his youth, and that's a very important part of the reality of this
story.
He's
a kid.
He's a kid, and what we're actually seeing is the process of growing up. And the fact that he ends up in a pit, not just once, but twice, basically for the inability to keep a check on himself, right, shows us that he is not fully formed, that Yosef HaTzadik, you know, Joseph the Righteous, whom we think of, you know, and that's one of the reasons people often are challenged and I think read these stories in very sort of apologetic ways, is because we look at the end of the process and say, well, he is the sort of emblematic character of righteousness, Yosef HaTzadik. How could it be that he, you know, said bad things about his brothers, or he's such a nudnik that he kept bragging to them about his dreams, or that he was perhaps tempted by the wife of Potiphar, as we'll discuss. The answer to that is, well, yeah, that's what happens in life. A tzaddik, a righteous person, is not someone who never is challenged or even never fails, right? Tzaddik sheva yipol vakum, right? Tzaddik falls down seven times and gets up. What makes you righteous is not the fact that you don't fall. What makes you righteous is that you always get up.
That's right. One of the most incredible Hasidic thoughts I ever read was also in the Netivot Shalom, and he said, sometimes God, he quoted somebody else, he said, sometimes God will challenge you in the following way. He will make sure that you fail. You will fall. You will fall. You will eat that piece of bacon. You will break, okay? And the challenge is not whether you could overcome eat that bacon or not, because he wants you to fall. He wants to see if you're going to get back up again.
Yes.
That's an incredible thing. I mean, it's a, you know, philosophically so problematic, so many, you know, but like that idea, like, will you get back up again?
It's also the power of chosen identity, meaning how much do I allow my failures to define me? And how much do I say, yes, I actually did that. I'm going to look it in the face. I see it as a failure.
I say,
afal pichen, nevertheless.
You see kids sometimes when things screw up for them or when they messed up, they feel like so angry and broken about that thing, and they're like locked into that one moment of failure.
Yes, that they identify with it. That's what I meant. Is instead of it being a failure, they become a failure.
Right.
And this is the trap that Yosef never falls into. But however, he does begin there. He's totally absorbed by these dreams. I mean, look, with all due respect to the difficulty of his treatment of his brothers, I mean, if you had dreams like these, wouldn't you want to share them?
I don't know.
I mean, it's a natural, he is the overflowing personality. And when he's 17 years old, he's running around just overflowing with the powers that are in him. He doesn't know what to do with them.
There's a lot of questions here. I agree with you that he is a catalyst of history. He's going to become a catalyst of history. Let's understand that when we talk about Joseph, we're talking about the guy who's the great man, the great righteous, you know, forefather of ours, who is going to set up the rest of the Bible, the rest of the Torah. The whole issue of the Exodus from Egypt is set up by Joseph, because he's going to be tasked with bringing the Jewish people into exile. It's not a simple thing. He is going to be the one in charge of bringing the whole Jewish family out of the land of Israel and into exile and setting them up there. And then that's going, and he's going to tell them, you know, there's going to be a redeemer. He's going to take you out of here. So he's really envisioning a whole set of things which are not really normative. It's not like kind of the right way to behave. A lot of his behavior, you kind of understand that it's like he's really serving God because he's beyond what I would choose as a normal task to do.
He evolves into that. And there's a critical moment at which we see that evolution. I don't know how quickly you want to move, you know, too far into the parasha. But the first time he comes out of the pit.
The pit, let's just tie in that for everybody. We're talking about, so the last thing we left off in terms of the narrative is that he's going to see his brothers. The brothers are going to see him from a distance. They're going to make some kind of plan. They grab him. The Torah is going to spare words there. You're not going to understand exactly what the physical...
Did they rough him up?
You know, by the way, speaking of roughing up, like, I just saw that video of the Russian ambassador getting murdered. And, you know, gosh, you know, like, just to see a life snuffed... Forget what the geopolitics involved. Just to see a life snuffed out like that, you're just like, wow. I mean, I was shocked that 3-4 bullets were shot, and then the guy dropped, and he stopped. He wasn't moving. He was gone.
No, it was all over.
It was all over, like, completely. He wasn't twitching or moving. He was out.
Yep.
And it was just like, whoa. You know, and that's the power and the problem of the modern visual world that we live in. But in any case, Joseph, the Torah wants to keep it, like, out of our reach to understand how it happened. But it's so, in one way or another, they grab him, and they're going to throw him into a pit in Dothan. By the way, that pit, and according to some, exists today.
Well, it certainly exists, whether we know where it is,
right,
or not.
No, there is a pit in Dothan that they actually take people to. My friends are going on a trek on Friday, but we don't know if exactly that's the one. But in the Dothan area, there is indeed this very, you know, big pit, and he's going to get chucked down there by his own brothers, mm-hmm. and they're going to sit down to eat bread and just to, like, think about it. This is a very problematic moment in Jewish history. They're going to, like, be like, you know, they're going to kind of, they've got some kind of pent-up rage. They're going to throw him down there. And then later in the Bible, much later, we're going to hear... Well, no, later in the book of Genesis, we're going to hear, like, our brother cry to us, and we didn't listen to him. So the Torah doesn't tell us here, but later on, the brothers are going to admit that he yelled out to them saying, hey, guys, you know, feed me, clothe me, help me, get me out of here. What's going on here?
So much of the way this is going to play out is in exactly that, in the way which the brothers come to understand what they've done in light of how events unfold. So much so that we both agreed and took for granted that it was the brothers that sold him into slavery.
Right. Oh, that's a good point.
Right, because...
I didn't say that. I said they threw him into the pit.
Right, because even though the sages will indeed insist that it was the brothers who eventually take him out of that pit, sell him to the Midianites to the Ishmaelites, and the Ishmaelites to the Mitzrim, and maybe a few people in between, the simple reading of the text seems that they threw him into the pit. They went somewhere else to have lunch.
Yeah.
And then while they were all planning what to do, someone else came along, pulled him out of the pit, and sold him.
That's right.
And it's one of the big questions I have here of why the sages, when they're so often willing, for instance, in the incident where the text of the Torah says that Reuven slept with his father's maidservant, and the sages insist, no, he did no such thing. In fact, what he did was he moved Jacob's bed from here to there, right? Meaning against what seems to be the plain text, they will explain something in a way which is not obvious. An attempt in the general way that's understood is in order that, why did the Torah say it so severely? To teach you how bad it was what he did. So here, they're actually looking at something which actually was bad, but it wasn't that bad, and they're actually making it worse. And I think that the reason that the sages insist that it was the brothers, even against what seems to be the plain text, is because they understood that that's how the brothers experienced it themselves. That the blood guilt that they carried, as you said, we heard the cries of our brother and we did nothing. As the rest of the story of exile unfolds, they must own. And they can't have any excuse that we didn't really do it, you know, we only did half of it. No, you have to let that all go, because I believe that the central message of the entire book of Genesis, which much of it comes to a head in these stories, is that you own your choices and that your choices are what makes history. And therefore, we cannot water down the brother's responsibility in any way, said the sages, even though we could. We could very easily read it otherwise.
It's basically from here on that the book of Genesis is just a very painful book, really, except for the last Torah portion in the book of Genesis. It's like really, it's going to be the brothers are going to, as you said, sell or in any case, even if they didn't sell him, the sages told them they sold us.
Yes,
the sages tell us they sold him. But even in the plain reading, it was their fault that he got sold. They threw him into a pit. They put him in this kind of situation.
No question. But you realize how significant this responsibility is when you scroll forward 3,000 years later. Maybe it's 2,000. I'll do the math some other time. Right? When in the famous incident that is recorded on Yom Kippur in our prayer book, when the Caesar comes to the 10 leading sages of Israel and says, the brothers were never punished for selling Joseph into the pit. I'm going to execute you all. And what do they say? Let us see if God agrees with you. And for ways that we're not going to discuss right now, they actually receive a divine response that indeed this is correct, and that the whole destruction that happened in the wake of the fall of the Second Temple was all because of what the brothers did to Joseph.
Wow. So that was, there was a blood guilt there, and it went on and
which
on.
Which is driving history.
Okay, and let's now shift gears into two stories that have deep sexual overtones. And moral as well, of course. But like suddenly, there's a shift. There's a subtle hint in the beginning that Joseph is good looking, and the sages will tell us more that let's put it this way: there's something about him that is pretty, that is attractive.
And he knew it.
And when he gets down to Egypt, he's sold. Piece of information that Judaism has is that as he's sold down the river, as he's sold down to Egypt, he's being carried on spice, in a spice caravan, so at least it smells good.
Yeah.
It's true, you know, you're losing your parents and your brothers sold you, and it's really, really horrible. But
at least it doesn't stink.
At least it doesn't stink. Cause
could be worse.
I like that a lot of times.
The could be worse thing never really speaks to me.
I just like the idea, like he's down there, he's all upset. But
oh, thank God.
Yeah, like
it's pleasant. Yeah.
Anyway, he's going down to Egypt, and he's going to be sold as a slave. And he's going to do very well. This is the Jew in exile. He's going to do well in the diaspora. He's going to become the kind of the quintessential figure, and later on, much later on, Mordechai after him, the hero of the tale of Esther, is going to be these successful folks out there.
And Esther as well, you know, they share that phrase of Motzei Chen, right? And that is really Yosef's characteristic. As you said, the Jew in exile. What does it mean to find grace or find favor in the eyes of others? It's this ineffable quality. You know, it's not cute. It's not beautiful. There's a certain shine about Yosef that just lets people know that this is someone I want to be close to, and they can get it done.
And he excels, right? He excels at everything he does. And basically, his master Potiphar, Mr. Potiphar, he is going to like let the servant kind of just be the head of the household, a little bit like Shawshank Redemption. Like he's gonna just take over everything, except for the wife. The wife he keeps at a distance from him, but this very wife, who the sages describe as a bear, in terms of her aggressiveness, she is going to make advances onto Joseph day in, day out, and she wants to lie with him. She wants to force him, and he keeps on resisting and saying no and talking about values and you're you know, nobody's entrusted like I am, and how could I do such a thing? And then one day, which we're told was the day when Joseph comes to do his work in the house, turns out that probably was some kind of holiday. It was like some kind of, like, let's call it some kind of, you know,
pagan festival.
Some kind of pagan festival where everybody went to the temple. She claims that she's sick that day, and somehow he comes to do his work. The sages disagree whether he was, that's it, he was ready to give into her wills, or in fact he was just doing his regular housework, not going to the pagan temple. But in any case, She tries to draw him in. She tries to draw him in, and he's resisting. The sages say that he saw an image of himself. He saw an image of himself.
Well, the sages say
an image of his father. Excuse me, I got confused because Rabbi.
Well, there's something very deep in it. What you said.
Right. Rabbi Sabata told us that she dragged him into the bedroom. There's a lot of mirrors there.
Right.
And he saw himself. And he himself looked just like his father.
Yes. And that's the death. We saw, and I think this brings us full circle to where we began, is that when it says that Yaakov loved Yosef more than the brothers, the sages give a number of reasons why. One of them is that Yosef looked just like Yaakov. And yet we get this description that the deeper into Egypt Yosef goes, actually the sages say he began to curl his hair and he was wearing, you know, makeup like the Egyptian men did at the time. And at a certain point you could see that he was ready to just do like the Egyptians did. Here's his day. He's just going to give in. She drags him in, and he sees his own reflection, but he sees what's behind the makeup and the curled hair. He sees his father's face, and he realizes that this is a moment he can choose who he is. You know, and the consequences are dire. He probably knows that if this goes poorly now, it's all over. His whole comfortable position that he's managed to be saved from slavery. Who knows but that God is now giving him the final opportunity to truly be in charge of the house, and he says, this is not who I am.
Right. So this is a very important thing you just said, that there may have been a thought in his head that through Eshet Potiphar to Mrs. Potiphar, there will be the pathway to be that person that he's supposed to become, this powerful viceroy of Egypt.
Yes.
Right? But I learned a fantastic Torah on this. How did he know that it wasn't true? How did he know that she wasn't the real pathway?
How did he know?
This is the best thing ever. Because it says in the Torah that she spoke to him day in, day out. And when he realized that she spoke to him every day, he was like, this can only be Yetzer Hara. It can only be the evil inclination.
Because it's the only.
The only thing that calls you day in, day out is the evil inclination.
That's right.
The
never takes a break.
Right. The good inclination like opens a little window. There's an opportunity. The window closes. But that if it speaks to you every day, forget it.
It's really true. It's really true.
He at the last second resists. And you know, on a plain human sexual interaction, this is a big deal. Like he really does not go in that direction that she wants him to go in, and he's able to overcome
the fullness of his desire,
right, and temptation. She grabs him by the coat, by the vest.
There's
that vest again.
Yes.
It's not the same vest, but she grabs him by this article of clothing. He leaves it in her hand. She uses that later on as proof that Joseph was the one who was forcing himself upon her. He's a rapist.
And this is the essence of who Joseph is. His brothers stripped him of his externals and threw him into a pit. And via that, he went on the great trial of his life into slavery. Now she will strip him of his externals. He will once again be thrown into the pit. And through that second, he will emerge now as Yosef HaTzadik, as the righteous that we know. Because the power of Yosef will be the fact that he can maintain his integrity and true identity no matter what the context he may find himself in, right? Because many of us, we shift according to our context. I wear these clothes, this is who I am. I wear those clothes, that's it. And he is the exact opposite. He will go into the depths of Egyptian society, and he will maintain a level of righteousness that most of us probably couldn't do if we sat in yeshiva all day. And that image of all she can take is his externals. All the brothers could do is strip off something which wasn't really his yet, that sign of nobility, but that he himself is going through a process through these twice into the pit, which from which he will emerge untouchable.
Right. Just to make it clear what you're talking about, the pit, he's going to be thrown into jail, but the Torah uses the same language as it's like a pit. It's like a dungeon, if you will. It's a dungeon, if you will. And he gets thrown down there. Let's take a break for a second from Yosef, because the Torah is going to take a little bit of a break, and it's going to tell us about another story. It's going to be a story within a story. So ostensibly, we're talking about one of the darkest moments of initial Jewish history. In any case, brothers selling brothers into slavery. We're really talking about Rabbi Mike and Isha, you guys talked about the forefathers. They're so holy and so important. God loves them. I mean, look at this. This is a broken household. What a joke. And you would think that things are really gone down. In fact, the leader of the brothers, Judah, he takes, let's call it kind of sabbatical. He's out. You know what? I'm tired of this. I don't need all this. I have a friend now who's like a Gentile, and I'm going to marry a Gentile woman, and I'm out. You know, I'm like an Israeli who moves to You know,
India.
Yeah, something like that. I'm out of your of all this mess of yours. And he's going to have Judah's going to have now. Judah's is the princely, the kingly brother. We're going to learn more about that later. But in any case, here he's going to just do a walkabout, get out a little bit of regular life. He's going to marry a woman, Bathsheba. She's ostensibly not from the tribes, not a Jew, not part of the story. He's going to have three children with her. And these children, Eronan and Shelah, he's going to marry off sequentially. Well, the third one not, but he's going to marry the first two off to this lady named Tamar. Tamar, she's kind of mysterious. Yet we learn that this Tamar is actually the daughter of Malchizedek, the daughter of Shem. She is a very noble. She comes from a very noble background, but she marries these two boys, and somehow the first son he does not want to
ruin her beauty.
He doesn't want to ruin her beauty. He doesn't want to consummate and procreate with her, and somehow he will not. Consummate the idea of union by spilling his seed outside, and that way not impregnating her. And God hates that very much, it seems, and he strikes him down, Onan. First one is Onan.
Air.
First is Er, and then the second one is Onan, who does the same thing. Er, he errs. He errs by doing that. By the way, his name is Er, which is the backward word ra, and indeed in God's eyes what he did is ra, it's bad. And then Onan does the same thing. He by levirate marriage marries his brother's sister, does the same thing, and God knocks him off as well. Weird. So two boys are dead. Obviously, to the naked eye, this lady is a man killer. Okay, and she goes back to her father's household. And Judah the father says, don't worry, I'll marry you off to Shelah when he gets older. But he has no intention of doing that. And then the wife of Judah is going to die. And Judah is, what's that word when somebody passes away and then after time you overcome the pain of it? He's
recovered, I mean, he's healed. He's
right. He finds solace in any case. And then at that point,
Comforted,
and he... He goes up to shear his sheep, and Tamar, this wonderful, incredible lady from an amazing past, but who seems to have lost two husbands, two of Judah's children died under her marriage. She's gonna get dressed up as a harlot, or cover her face. Gonna kind of do an end run, find where Judah's going to be, entice him to lay with her, and get impregnated. Later on, when it's found out that she was impregnated, she never reveals herself to Judah who she really is. Later on, when she becomes pregnant, she's showing, somebody reveals to Judah, hey, your daughter-in-law is a harlot. She's become pregnant to harlotry. And he's like, we gotta kill her. We gotta burn her. Now, I forgot to mention that she had asked for no payment as a harlot, as a fake harlot. She asked only for a...
Guarantee.
Guarantee. What's it called when you...
Collateral.
Collateral. And this collateral was the signet ring, the cloak, and the staff of Judah. And as she's being taken out to be summarily executed, she sends these and she says, I am pregnant. I am with child to the owner of these. And Judah... Instead of being like, I don't know what she's talking about.
I'll find that guy later.
I did not inhale, okay? I had no idea. he says about her, she's righteous. She was more righteous than I. Yes, it is me. And I was supposed to give her my son Shelah. I wasn't going to. And she did everything right. This wild story is a story that many people do not know about the Torah. And of course... Those who know that it's really the story of Mashiach.
That's right.
It's how Mashiach is born.
Well, and eventually what comes from this union is twins. You know, and these twins represent the depth of the complexity of the story of Mashiach. Not only the sort of sexual confusion that's happening there, which we see already because the female side of Mashiach comes from the Moabite nation, which we mentioned a few parshiot ago, which is Lot's daughters sleeping with their father. That's on the female side there. Here on the male side, we have the daughter-in-law who dresses as the harlot and seduces her father-in-law, and then the confusion. And then what comes out of it is, of course, in the ancient world, the firstborn inherits, right? Not in the Bible, though. And we see consistently in the Bible, the firstborn never actually inherits, not any firstborn of significance, right? And here, who's the firstborn between Peretz and Zerach, the two twins that are born to Tamar of this union?
Well, a hand comes out.
Yeah.
And then the hand, as the
and
hand
the midwife
out,
ties a red string around the hand, and says, this one's firstborn.
The hand is retracted.
And then the other child is
born. The other child is born.
And she calls him Peretz, which means right. you busted through.
Right.
Right. And he, who is actually biologically firstborn, but technically not, will be the line of Mashiach. Right. Which is begs this question about the nature of how redemption emerges, right? Because I think that we all have a very sort of simplistic, naive notion about redemption, which is that, well, things will just get better and goodness must come from a very clean, straight line development. Whereas the Bible is begging us in this whole parsha, whether it's the fact that, listen, what came out of the Exodus from Egypt? The receiving of the Torah. Well, but how did we get down there at the beginning? Oh, well, Joseph's brothers beat him up, threw him in the pit. You know, meaning the messiness of life is actually what allows for the emergence of moral growth, of spiritual maturity, of divine revelation. And here, the story has to be as bad as it could be in order that the whole world break down, in order that a new order emerge.
And we also see that Judah accepts responsibility. This is going to be his... He's going to start rising up through this story, as you're talking about emerging, as a person who accepts responsibility. And in fact, is going to later on, we're going to see a few Torah portions from now, that he's going to accept responsibility for what has happened to Joseph.
And that's exactly what's going to point out, is that Joseph knows that in order for his painful sort of story to be redemptive, that he must bring about that the brothers will actually own the responsibility. Like I said at the beginning, right? This part of Bereishit is coming to teach us is that redemption comes when a person owns their actions and moves forward toward the clarity of redemption.
And the other subtext here is that Mashiach has to kind of be clever. He's got to come through.
Yeah, almost, there's no straight line.
If he comes through a straight line, he's going to be stopped. He's a little bit like he's a little secret agent.
But I think it's also because, like, there's this simplistic notion that Mashiach is already, like, the idea of Mashiach is already out there. And if everybody just agreed with me about what it was, the world would be redeemed, right? And the reality is, no, Mashiach is a revolution. It takes a leap of imagination, which takes us outside of the world as we know it.
Right. And you wonder sometimes why in the Jewish world, like, we get back to very simplistic tracks of what things are supposed to look like. When the Torah story is like nothing but.
Because, imagination is one of the greatest demands you can put on a person.
Right, and it's also scary because you can't control it. Because you can't own it. You can't say, I got it.
Can't just analyze the situation and figure out which way to go.
Okay, the last bit in this, and the folks, Rabbi Mike has got to go teach a class coming up, so we're a little bit rushed more than usual. That's okay. We'll catch up. The last bit here is Joseph is in jail. Once again, he becomes the kind of, main inmate, the kind of top dog inmate, the alpha inmate, if you will. And he takes control of the prison. And he's imprisoned with two important ministers. One is the minister of the drinks, and the other one is the baker. And these two guys have a dream in one night, and the one dream is that the one in charge of drinks is like, I see grapevines, and there's like three levels of them. I grab some grapes, I squish them into the cup of Pharaoh, and I don't know what that means. Joseph is like, well, let me try a hand in it. I'm good with dreams. And he says, what it means is in 3 days, you will be taken back to your position, and you will indeed pour wine for Pharaoh. And then the baker is like, hey, that sounds good. I'd like an answer too. My dream is that there are three baskets of bread, and the birds are eating from the top basket of the bread. What does this mean? Because in 3 days, you're going to be hanged, and the birds of the field are going to eat your flesh. And he says to the first guy, he says, don't forget me, babe, right? Don't forget me. Don't forget me when you're back out. And indeed, he does get forgotten. In fact, the rabbis tell us that Joseph gets a little bit punished. He spends an extra 2 years in jail because he asked to be remembered, by a mere fleshling.
Right, and we really realize why he was punished when he finally is taken out. And that's, you know, after literally years in prison, after having been sold down into slavery, after trying to understand the temptations and how he made the right decision, but he's being punished, finally, Pharaoh has his famous dream. And that's going to come at the beginning of next week's Parsha. But when he's, and we'll speak about it at more length then, but when he's whisked out of prison and he's dusted off and placed in front of Pharaoh, the first word that comes out of his mouth is, "It's not me." And it's in this that we see that Yosef's evolution toward Tzaddik has finally been achieved, is that he understands that everything which has occurred to him, but not because of him. And that he, his mission in the world is to be a vehicle for redemption. And in order to do that, you must be absolutely who you are. You must own your actions. You must live your life. It is not an abstraction. And yet you must do it for the sake of God.
I think there's one more lesson that we can learn about who gets hanged. And that's the minister of carbohydrates. Carbohydrate gets hanged, but who gets saved? The minister of hydration.
Okay? L'chaim.
There you go. You got to drink more L'chaim and eat a little bit less muffins and croissants, and then that's going to be good. That's a little subtle hint that the Torah is telling us. Rabbi Mike Foyer, sadly we're out of time. There's so much more to talk about, but it's great to be back with you here.
It's always next week.
And Spiritual Cafe. Sadly, next week is another skip week. Hopefully, we'll get back together after that. And also, another little thing that we, I don't know, we've got to find an opportunity to talk about it, which is Hanukkah.
Yeah,
that's
true.
This great holiday of light that's coming, and that there's so much efforts out there in the world to darken Israel's light. The war of the Maccabees continues. We're still fighting it today. And I think you're one of the great fighters for the Maccabees today. Thank you, Rabbi Mike.
You are as well, my friend. Chazak me'amat.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, Land of Israel, thelandofisrael.com, a great network. Rabbi Mike Foyer and Spiritual Cafe joins me. Stay tuned. More great stuff is on the way. We'll be right back, and shalom.
Hanukkah light burns so bright. Hanukkah, oh Hanukkah, come light the menorah. Open my lockers in the air sometimes.
Light one candle for the Maccabee children.
Hi everybody, Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation. On behalf of myself and all of the hosts and wonderful staff behind the Land of Israel Network, I want to wish all of you a happy Hanukkah, a joyous festival of lights, and may we here at the Land of Israel Network continue to shine the light of Israel on the world. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening and supporting us.
This is Eve Harrow, host of Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. My maternal grandparents, Grandpa Morris and Grandma Lily, came to the United States from Russia over 100 years ago. They belonged to the Mizrahi movement way before there was even a state of Israel. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement.
Hey folks, this is Jeremy Gimpel. I want you to know, if you're a non-Jew from a Christian background or just a full-fledged Christian and you want to come to Israel, the best program, tour, experience that you could possibly have is to go with Hayovel. Now it's weird, I'm an Orthodox Jewish rabbi and I'm telling Christians to go to this Christian ministry in the middle of Samaria. Let me tell you, there is no better experience for someone outside of the land, outside of the Jewish fold, to come into the land and work alongside the Jewish farmers of Samaria, to learn about the culture, to meet the people. It's an experience like no other, and I think it's also probably the cheapest way to travel to Israel. So go to hayovel.com.
The best place to stay in Jerusalem is at Windows of Jerusalem Vacation Apartments. Check out their website, www.windowsofjerusalem.com. They've got beautiful 1, 2, 3, 4-bedroom apartments in the best location in the city center with the most beautiful, breathtaking views. And I mean breathtaking. I've stayed there a number of times myself. And I'm telling you, there are few places anywhere in the city where you can take it all in to this degree. The view, the location, the great apartments, plus the wonderful staff will truly make you feel at home in Jerusalem. Book your stay now at windowsofjerusalem.com.